Welcome to MetaStrategy's Forum on World-Class IT, a weekly conversation with people who are shaping the technology landscape. I'm Peter High, and I'm pleased to welcome Naresh Shankar back to the broadcast. Naresh is the Chief Information Officer of HP Inc., a $52 billion personal computer and printing-focused company, which some refer to as the founding company of Silicon Valley. As CIO, Naresh leads HP global IT strategy and operations and is responsible for application development, data management, technology infrastructure, cyber and product security, data center operations, and telecommunication networks. Prior to becoming CIO of HP, Naresh was the CIO of HP's Printing and Personal Systems Group. And prior to that, he was the CIO of Palm Computing. Naresh earned a Bachelor of Science degree in Computer Science and an MBA, both from the Illinois Institute of Technology in Chicago. I recently caught up with Naresh in his office in Palo Alto, California, and our conversation covered World-Class IT Principle 2, infrastructure, as Naresh discussed the IT changes necessary to compete in the on-demand technology economy, such as moving from systems of record to systems of engagement. Principle 3, project and portfolio management, as Naresh shared how he prioritizes his approach to managing the breakup of Hewlett-Packard into HP Inc. and HP Enterprise. And Principle 4, IT and business partnerships, as he discussed the ways in which he aligns IT strategy to the rapidly evolving business strategy as the company transforms for the digital economy, among other topics. If you like what you hear, we'd be grateful if you give us a rating on iTunes or through whatever other source you use for podcasts. Thank you. Naresh Shankar, welcome to the Forum on World-Class IT.
Thank you, Peter.
It's great to speak with you.
Happy to be here.
Yes. So, Naresh, you are, of course, the Chief Information Officer of HP Inc., and that is a company that has had quite a consequential couple of years now, having gone through a significant separation into HP Inc., the original company, and now HP Enterprise, a separate company. Of course, you were involved on both sides of that that transformation. And I thought we'd begin the conversation with that process, one of the biggest separations in corporate history. Can you talk about just the scale of that, the way in which you thought about the planning of separating this $120 billion company into two $60 billion companies, if I recall correctly, and the process of standing this company up as a separate entity?
So let me start with the approach and the process we put in place to fundamentally, what I'd say, separate and transform our companies. The first approach we took was to determine what was the absolute mandatory minimum requirements to be able to meet the regulatory requirements and compliance requirements of being an independent and separated company, so that we could actually prioritize and execute the entire separation within 12 months. A feat which was no small task and had never been accomplished before for a high-tech company of this magnitude and scale and complexity. So the first thing was around really defining the scope of what was mandatorily required. After that, what we did was to actually look at what it would take to fundamentally stand up two entities publicly, two public companies, HP Enterprise and HP Inc. HP Enterprise focused on all of our compute, network, storage solutions, coupled with HP software, and also HP Enterprise Services. And HP Inc., the focus was predominantly around our printing business, our personal systems business, and 3D additive manufacturing business. So the focus was really around how do we fundamentally separate out the architectures all the way from the infrastructure layer, the wide area networks, local area networks, to the underlying solutions, which is the whole applications fabric, including several of the facilities and sites worldwide that had to be separated and secure, so that we could basically deem ourselves separated entities and meet all of the reinvent ourselves, taking advantage of the separation, so that we could compete in our independent markets much more aggressively and in a much more focused manner. So the first thing we did was lay out a five-year roadmap, where 2015 was what I'd classify for HP Inc. was the separation year. 2016 was the year standing up the company and all of our independent operations. IT was a significant part of putting in place, rebuilding all of the operations and the capabilities ground up from the infrastructure layer to the applications layer, and to put in place all of the operational metrics and SLAs so that we could stabilize and run our operations on a 24/7 cadence. 2017 was really focused on starting our whole transformation journey. And our goal was from 2017 through 2020, complete the execution of our transformation journey. A significant portion of it in flight, and almost most of it having completed. Where we are right now is our focus as a company, and from a strategic point of view, is to really pivot our company from being what I'd call a transaction-oriented, and our systems were much more designed around transactions and physical goods flows. And our goal was to actually pivot our company to being much more contractual and digital centric. So how do we move from a hardware player to being much more of a solutions services player, where the strategic focus was building brands, businesses that were targeted much more towards a solutions and services oriented company, and with a much more digital mindset. And so that is what we laid out from an IT architecture point of view, to actually start the foundation of this journey, so that we could pivot ourselves to being a digital company focused on two things. One is to support an omni-channel go-to-market strategy, and second, a what I call everything as a service play, which was really around solutions and services across all lines of business. So with that in mind, we basically, this separation actually served as the catalyst to help us actually pivot ourselves from a physical goods and hardware OEM manufacturer to much more of a digital goods, solutions and services technology company. So that is really the focus. And as we go forward, we will continue to evolve our solutions and services with much more user-centered experiences and designs in mind, which is really ensuring that the entire user experience, the entire partner experience, the entire customer experience was really delivered with a digital mindset. So that is fundamentally how we have actually transformed ourselves coming off the separation, using it as an opportunity and a catalyst to help us meet the objectives of being a digital player in the industry.
What a fascinating journey, and an extraordinarily complex, I can only imagine. And it strikes me, Naresh, that the transformation that you've been leading is in many ways a transformation that's necessary across a number of industries. As the saying goes, as most companies are becoming technology companies to one degree or another. And moreover, as many sort of digital immigrant organizations need to compete to a greater degree with digital native organizations. And I'm curious, as a leader, the CIO of perhaps the original Silicon Valley company, one of the most legendary of those organizations, and the kind of transformation that you've been a part of, and going from this OEM physical goods organization to one that is oriented towards digital solutions to a greater extent. Can you talk a little bit more about, sort of peel back the onion a bit more, about the changes that are necessary from an IT perspective in order to deliver that?
Yeah. So when you step back and look at what customers, partners, and end users expect in today's world, we live in what I call an instant-on economy. You consume technology when you want to consume it, and you pay for it when you use it. So we really are living in what I call an on-demand, instant-on economy. And that's where directionally all companies are designing their user experiences for. So for us to be able to enable this sort of real-time and dynamic experience that customers, partners, and end users expect, what we have to fundamentally do is decompose the entire architecture of a heritage company and really make sure that we could transform the company to being much more of a mindset that was much more digitally oriented, to be able to meet what I call the objectives of an instant-on, on-demand economy, right? And to be able to meet the real-time needs of what customers and partners and end users expect, especially as we go forward to being much more solutions and services-oriented, we had to incorporate a lot of design thinking principles into the ecosystem. And when we talk about digital, digital is nothing more than the new world business models that we have to go enable. I mean, to me, that's what digital means. It's this whole new world of business models where you're actually catering to a much more instant-on and an on-demand economy. In addition, this is a hyper-connected economy. And so what we ended up having to do was saying, okay, for us to be able to deliver this real-time experience, the first thing we needed to do was take the organization that was much more focused around a heritage kind of set of legacy capabilities and pivot them to having capabilities that were much more focused around things like product management, user-centered design, more agile methods to deliver solutions, and much more focused around time to value and time to market metrics. Okay, so that was the first thing we had to do, was take this whole fabric of the organization and its capabilities and make sure it was actually designed and prepped to be able to meet the new challenges of a digital economy. The second thing we ended up having to do was actually focus on ensuring that the architectures that were once designed to support a heritage company were now pivoted into being much more of a plug-and-play architecture with a far more superior application integration framework, so that we could move very quickly to stitch services end-to-end or even solutions end-to-end and deliver these solutions to market very rapidly. So a much more modular and plug-and-play architecture. The third thing we did was to move from what I call CapEx type models or cost structures to more OpEx and more variabilized cost structures. What that meant was moving from fixed data center costs to more on-demand, instant-on compute, right? And so that was another big pivot we had to do. There are some other areas of focus that we went down, which is also ensuring that we designed not for transactional experiences. We had to move from systems of record to systems of engagement. We had to design from transactional end-to-end experiences to what I call more digital sorts of experiences that were really designed around user-centered design, okay? And so these were some of the waves of shifts that we had to very rapidly make in the organization to prepare ourselves for launching these new capabilities to support an instant-on, on-demand economy. So now let's peel back the onion in terms of architecturally, what are the roadmaps we've put in place? Why? So, and then I'm going to talk to you about examples around what specific business services are we starting to launch incrementally and rapidly into the open marketplace.
Great.
The first thing we did was the applications infrastructure. We have numerous telco providers today that support the entire wide area networks worldwide. The biggest challenge with having numerous players was because was simply we couldn't get a consistent delivery of service across our wide array networks and a consistent user experience to be enabled, because all of these solutions were heavily network sensitive and much more what I'd call cloud-based architectures. So because they were providing more real-time interactions. So the first thing we did was actually transform the entire wide area networks, and we're on a journey to consolidate to a single wide area fabric worldwide so that we had consistent delivery of the capability and the experiences at a global level. The second thing we did was move to a consistent Wi-Fi fabric worldwide, which we completed last year. And today we are now running on a standard, consistent Wi-Fi fabric worldwide. So these were fundamental in terms of being able to deliver the right sorts of experiences. The third area is to look at all the front office solutions that actually touch customers, partners, and end users. And so we embarked on this journey of doing a global CRM transformation to automate all of our sales operations, including all of our consumer commercial call centers worldwide. And this was a priority because these areas touch customers every day. And so it was important for us to move this segment of folks that interacted with us to much more digital experience and a digital mindset. How do you weave a customer experience and a partner experience and employee experience so that it's a full 360 view end to end, and we support them worldwide since they buy all of our products across print and PC. And so the goal was to make sure that we had a consistent end to end user experience. So the first thing was to be able to digitize the entire user experience in the CRM fabric for both sales and commercial consumer call centers worldwide. The second thing was to make sure that we have a back office operation that actually supports the front office. And so we have now embarked on a journey to consolidate our entire back office operations globally. And that is on track to complete in 36 months. And the goal is to make sure we have a full front end and back end stitched that is much more cloud enabled and architected to deliver an end user experience that's heavily or highly digitized, so that we can provide this entire seamless delivery of solutions and services to our customers and meet the time to market and time to value goals.
I wanted to ask you, associated with that, there still are a great number of CIOs who have profound impacts and touch points to internal processes and operations. But still, unfortunately, not the average CIO has the same kind of opportunity to transform customer-facing experience. And I find it very interesting that you've had your hand in both sides of that. And I'm curious, the method of engagement as you think about user experience when the users are customers, how do you and your team engage customers of the company?
Yeah. So we have a governance framework that actually looks at the investment portfolio. So what's really important in our company is that we every day stitch the company's or business strategy against the IT strategy. And as the business strategy continues to evolve for us, as we move from what I call, again, a hardware manufacturer to more of a digital player to meet the expectations of the digital economy, what we have had to do is actually make sure that we have a very sound and clear understanding of what the business strategies are as we go forward. We then very quickly and rapidly put in place the enabling portfolios in terms of where and how we're going to invest to deliver this entire 360 end-to-end experience. Now, on the back end, we also have a very sophisticated roadmap on analytics, which is also very, very critical. So what we've had to do is understand the business strategies, and then how do we cascade those strategies into the enabling portfolios and the architectures we need to put in place on the back end to provide this whole end-to-end digitized experience. And so so we have a very, I'd say, stringent process in terms of how we develop the business cases for the business strategies that we're going to go invest in. And then those have a governance body or a governing body that actually reviews this company-wide and then determines where the investments are going to be made. And so starting out, we've made decisions on some key strategies where we're going to be pivoting off to focus from a digital perspective in terms of how we take key solutions and services to market. So one key solution that we're delivering today is called Instant Ink, and it's all subscription-based set of services. Another key set of services is around MPS, which is also called Managed Print Services. And a full service for print for SMB and commercial customers worldwide available, okay? The third focus area for us going forward is device as a service. And this is to provide, again, SMBs and commercial customers with a full 360 managed service for all of their client compute solutions or end user compute solutions, whether it be a phone, a tablet, or a PC, and or its various form factors. So device as a service. In some businesses, like in some of our more advanced printing solutions, we've developed a lot of solutions around click revenue, okay, and pay-as-you-go models. So we are gradually moving our entire set of hardware solutions to be now extensible, where you can now launch various what I call services and solutions off our platforms. So the entire personal systems has platforms of its own. The printing group has platforms. And then you also have the 3D additive manufacturing group as well that is enabling all its hardware architectures in the form of platforms. The moment you move into a platform play across these various business units and or business properties, it now affords you and gives you the opportunity to actually launch a whole set of solutions services off these platforms. And very quickly, with the fact that you're now designing for an end user experience up front in the life cycle, it now very quickly allows you and enables you to actually deliver these solutions to market very rapidly using a lot more back-end plug-and-play architectures to deliver these services. So the approach we've taken is, number one, we have a governance structure in place that determines how investments are going to be made across the company based on key business strategies. We then map that to the underlying enabling architectures and portfolios within IT that we put in place to enable this experience. And so comprehensively now, we work very, very closely to really stitch this entire 360 view around the solutions and services we deliver. More importantly, to ensure that we can actually deliver this digitized experience that both customers, partners, and end users have come to expect in everything we do today in the marketplace. So hopefully that gives you some insight in terms of how we've had to go about structuring this in a fairly thoughtful and methodical manner to ensure that we are actually generating real value for the investments we make across the company.
That's great. And I know, Naresh, from our past correspondences that you're also going through a rather large transformation from a customer relationship management or CRM perspective. Can you share some anecdotes from that, please?
Yeah. I mean, as I mentioned, the priority for us was to first build out an experience for basically our customers, our partners, and our employees. And so what we embarked on a journey was to actually look at how can we stitch a really great user experience that transcends all the spaces around the sales experience to the consumer and commercial experience for everyone that touches the HP ecosystem and everyone that wants to engage with us and consume our technology. How do we make it simple for them to consume the technology? How do we make it simple for them to consume the support services? How do we make it simple for them to have access to all of the cross-sell, upsell opportunities when they are looking for a total solution experience, right? And in the past, what we've had is actually numerous disparate systems that have been built over 15 to 25 years through several acquisitions we've made as a company. And so what we embarked on doing is actually designing and re-engineering all of our processes across sales operations, including all of our processes around consumer and commercial call centers, to ensure that the agents were well-equipped, both on the sales side as well as on the consumer and commercial call center side, to support customers globally, so that it gave them a very simple way to engage with us, consume our technology, not just from a solution point of view, but also from a services point of view. So the first thing we ended up doing was completely re-engineer the entire landscape, okay? And so that's number one. And the second thing was to really ensure that the investments we were gonna make yielded the savings we expected. And so we made a set of investments, and the business case afforded us basically delivering these, what I call fairly advanced capabilities, resulting in $90 million in cost savings, okay? This was a very significant business case. We also ended up having, this would also end up being the first what I call enterprise-grade instance of service and support and sales globally for us on a single footprint of technology, supporting over 6,500 sales representatives, over 200,000 partners, 17,000 call center agents, and over 50 million plus customers worldwide. So these are some fairly significant metrics that we had to ensure that the solution could manage both from a scope, scale, and complexity point of view, especially since, like I mentioned, we were coming off what I'd call a much more heritage landscape that was built over numerous acquisitions over the last 15 to 25 years. So this was a daunting task, and we were very successfully able to deploy the solution in 12 months, while most companies from a benchmark standpoint would have expected to deliver these solutions over a 24 and 36 month cycle. So huge value generated both from a time to market and time to value from a business case and benefits point of view achieved in record time, which was inside of 12 months.
Extraordinary. And this is not the first time in this conversation when you're talking about Herculean efforts delivered in times that were, you know, practically record. I'm thinking about what you talked about, the 12-month transformation at the separation. What do you attribute your team's ability to go through these massive exercises successfully in times that most benchmarks would suggest at the outset are in fact unrealistic?
Yeah, I think it has a lot to do with, I'd say, focus, speed, and accountability. The fundamental tenets in terms of what we always put in place when we embark on these large-scale transformations. The first thing is really around the governance. And when you look at transformations at this scale, you start with very strong executive sponsorship all the way from top down, from the CEO down to the ranks of the company. So the first thing is around, very strong executive sponsorship. The second thing is around putting in place the right governance and operating structure to actually deliver this program, where there's very strong business accountability and very strong IT accountability to drive this program end to end to achieve the desired results. And everyone is on the same page in terms of what we want to achieve as a company, both from a time to market and time to value point of view. So making sure that, all stakeholders on the same page to achieve the results before we embark on this journey. So I think fundamentally setting the tone in terms of, you know, that this is a company-wide priority. Two, this is the governance structure and accountability structure that we're planning to put in place. We have full support in terms of managing escalations and the execution in what I call is something we developed coming off the separation and we continue to use in all of our transformation exercises, which is a 24-48-hour cycle to raise the material issue and close it with either a plan for a plan or a resolution in 48 hours. So this whole mindset around the 24-48-hour execution cycle on, you know, ensuring that we address material issues without letting them fester, really, really important in the governance and execution structure we've put in place. And several of these principles that we have put in place right now are actually derived from a lot of the principles we established around our separation journey.
Extraordinary, the number of ancillary benefits for having gone through that initial significant exercise, the number of things that it has spawned, both in terms of process improvements that can be leveraged in different ways, but as you point out, even providing the impetus in some ways for the digital transformation that you described.
Now, the other thing I did want to highlight, Peter, is besides HP, you know, putting in place what was required to be successful and committed to ensuring the success of this program, it was also just as important for the partners we worked with to understand the importance of this journey. So we were able to partner with world-class players to help us actually work together as a single team to go develop and deploy this experience worldwide. So that was also really, really important, making sure that we partnered with world-class players to help us actually execute this journey.
Very, very good. Well, Naresh Shankar, thank you so much for joining us on the Forum on World Class IT. It's been a great conversation as usual.
Thank you, Peter.
Thanks for listening to the Forum on World Class IT. If you like what you've heard, please rate us on iTunes or through whatever other source you use for podcasts. And please join me next week when my guest will be the father of the internet, Vint Cerf.
You've just listened to a podcast in a series we call MetaStrategies Forum on World Class IT. If you like what you've heard, please consider reading my book, World Class IT, Why Businesses Succeed When IT Triumphs, published by Josie Bass, a division of Wiley Press, in December of 2009. Both the book and the forum on World Class IT offer stories from a wide range of top IT leaders relating to MetaStrategy's five principles of World Class IT. The five principles are as follows. Principle one is people, and it's really the foundational principle. Without the right people doing the right jobs at the right time, it'll be nearly impossible to achieve excellent performance. The second principle is infrastructure. We like to say that this is the principle that separates proactive organizations from reactive ones. If infrastructure is not reliably performing its tasks, the IT organization will become stuck in reactive mode, consistently fighting fires. If systems and hardware and networks and so on work reliably, then a larger portion of the organization can think about the future. The third principle is project and portfolio management. This is the engine through which new capabilities can be brought to bear on behalf of the company. It is important to ensure that projects are delivered on time, on budget, and on target, and that the portfolio collectively supports the objectives of the business. The fourth principle is IT and business partnerships. It's important that, first and foremost, the different parts of IT, from business analysis to development and QA, through to support and all other aspects of IT, communicate effectively and efficiently. It's equally important, then, that IT develop a partnering relationship with the business that it is a part of. If the three prior principles are done well, then IT should earn a place at the strategy setting table, driving different parts of the business strategy. The fifth and last principle is external partnerships. Outsourcing is becoming a crucial weapon that organizations are employing, and managing these relationships to ensure that value is achieved is critical. In the fourth principle, the organization has learned and contributed to the discussion about what is strategic and what is not. Once that's clear, then it will be easier to determine which aspects of IT might be better managed by external partners or vendors. For more information on these five principles and the sub-principles that are associated with each, please visit our website at www.metastrategy.com, and please share your thoughts and comments by contacting us at feedback@metastrategy.com. And our theme music was written by David Armin. I'm Peter High. Thanks for listening.